Welcome to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Breguet. Today is September 8th. It's 3 days before the 7th anniversary of September 11 and the attacks. And I am speaking this evening with some truth activists, including our first guest, Janice Matthews, who's the executive director of 911truth.org. But she has also been a tireless activist, a grassroots organizer in Kansas City many, many years ago with the 9/11 Visibility Project. And she has been very hardworking, patiently taking up the challenge of doing more and more organizational responsibilities with the national group, 911truth.org, which is, I must say, a huge challenge, and I my hat's off to Janice, because it's been a tremendous amount of work, and I know just from personal experience, it's really hard to do the local organizing, it's really hard to do the national, it's hard to do the international, and you sure can't do everything, and you've done so much to help the movement. I want to welcome you to the show, Janice, and would you like to give an update on, from your position being organizing so many conference calls amongst grassroots organizers, about what's happening in the United States and internationally right now with a movement at this moment in time?
Well, thanks, Carol, and thanks for that kind praise. I'm not locally acting in Kansas City anymore. I've moved away, and Ed Kendrick has taken over organizing that group, but we sure did have a great group there for years, and that carries on under Ed's leadership there now, and Reed Simpson and some Sharon Lockhart, some people who've been working so hard for so long. Gosh, you know, I was just sitting here looking through our calendar of events for September 11th, and I know that we are missing quite a few events, and nonetheless, I have here 5 pages of events, from Madrid to Australia to Oslo. Of course, you talked about the Canadian events last week, which is so exciting. And then across the United States, Des Moines, Iowa was able to secure a mainstream theater like in Oakland. Chicago street activism, Washington, D.C., Austin, you know, Boston, and, of course, New York City's 2008 Now or Never events that are coming up. And then in addition to those events, there are a number of marches, walks, and commemorative sort of reflections and fundraisers for the 9/11 responders that are happening. So I know that the march in Brussels yesterday was a fabulous success, and just did receive a report about that, apparently over 500 people. I didn't even get to read it yet, but that's, people came from all across Europe, and they organized with each other across Europe for that, and it was completely grassroots-led. I mean, a couple people put the idea out there, and then it was up to everybody to make it happen, which I think is such an incredible model. So
yeah,
that's what I
do know. I do know. I read that it was raining, and they did it despite the rain. So that's really, I bet you would have been even more people if it hadn't been raining. It's so hard to do it in the rain. So, but
well, you know, all those years of standing out there in the heat and the cold and frostbite on our fingers and toes from holding these huge signs that said support the 9/11 families when people went, who are the 9/11 families and what do they need support for? And I just am amazed at what people are willing to do for this effort. And, I mean, all these years later, I'm still just stunned at what people sacrifice and, put up with inconveniences and discomforts. And I'm amazed with people. And in the grand scheme of things, our minimal discomforts now are nothing given what we're really up against. But nonetheless, there's just not very many people who stand out in the freezing sleet and cold and heat. And I'm I'm really honored to be affiliated with such a group of people who care this much.
Last night we had a dinner for Bob Bowman in Palo Alto, and Paul Zaremka were there, and a lot of people from the movement, and it was just so heartwarming to hear everybody's story, and also to know that those people who did little things, it was sometimes just a flyer or a deception dollar or one watching of one film, which transformed people's lives, and I know that it's only through the grassroots efforts that we are achieving, a greater critical mass. And I can't help feeling that, despite the resistance, that the truth will prevail.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with you. It will. Not sure what it'll take, but it will. And even now, we know that the majority of people, the truth has prevailed already with the majority of people. And we certainly are hearing that all across Europe and Australia, for instance. So now how that's turned into action for that majority of people is the question. And I, you know, sound like a broken record, but it really comes down to the question of whether or not we want to live in a republic. It's really that simple. And republics don't run themselves well. So if we want one, we have to participate. It's participatory democracy. Constitutional republic. So, you know, I guess I'm not sure what it'll take for the majority who know, you know, truth, or at least we've been lied to get to the point where they'll say, you know, yeah, I really want to live in a republic and get busy. So.
Well, I think that still takes a lot of education. And even out here in California, you don't even hear that word. You don't even hear that notion of republic. That's more Midwestern or Eastern, I would say. I get it, but I've been doing this for a while. I think right now there more people are waking up, but there's still so many people just in the trance, and just clinging to the notion that we have a democracy, even though the civil rights are being violated. I'm hopeful too that the fact that we do have so many new films, and they are being shown abroad, like the film we're premiering on Thursday at the Grand Lake Theater, Zero. I think you mentioned on your website today that it's going to be shown in Russia, and probably 20 million people will see it. Now that's
right.
Bound to have some impact when the whole world knows, and the Americans are like the last to find out what their government did and what their government's up to. It's not too good, but I can't help feeling that, especially with the internet, that we are reaching a critical mass. I know every single day I'm just astonished at who's coming forward. We had a rally in March in San Francisco on Saturday, and.
Right.
We had about 50 people who were participating, I'd say, in the parade to the Power to the Peaceful, where there were 50,000 people. We had the replica. We had lots of banners. We had lots of signs. Actually, it was probably more than 50 people because we stretched out for a while. I just didn't count noses. But I think we had a large, you know, visual impact on the crowd. We just distributed thousands and thousands of pieces of literature, and a White House insider came to our booth, and I was introduced to him, and he's going to be on my show next week, and I was just sort of surprised that he was willing to speak out publicly. So both he and Bob Bowman will be on the show next week. But it's great that we have more people who have been on the inside, who know the inner workings of the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex and the White House, and are willing to come forward right now. I think one reason they can do it is because there is a movement that can carry the message. They're not going to be completely isolated.
Yes. I, as a matter of fact, got a call from someone who, this week, who's not coming forward yet, but who's inside, and we talked about what that's like, that I really don't want to give very much information because I agreed to be confident. But it was a person who was there, and that yes, pretty much these questions are being asked by all of them, but they don't ever bring it up with each other. And occasionally something will sort of come out, and they're careful not to speak the questions that they have. And we talked about how somehow that feels like disloyalty to those who died that day. It was very interesting to me to be able to hear this person talk genuinely about the psychological difficulties and the, it's not exactly denial, it's not denial, but people have a sense that it's disloyal to talk about this. Somehow it's dishonoring to those who died. And I had another call a couple weeks ago from this guy who's a firefighter who called and said he was really insulted that we would question this. And we ended up talking about 2 hours, and I said, you know, I really want you to hear me say something to you. I know that a lot of firefighters have talked with people about this in a sort of open manner. But there's a general understanding among firefighters that somehow we're being disrespectful to you by asking these questions. But, you know, in my mind, none of you should have died that day. So this is the ultimate respect to you, and I know that you don't quite get that, but you have to know that all of the people who are fighting for the truth here, this is all about respect for you and the other people who died that day. And he really heard me. And he heard that for the first time, and he somehow it clicked through some sort of psychological barrier that he had up. And, you know, he didn't agree with me then on having these questions, but he really appreciated that, and it really meant a lot to him to just, like, get that. So, you know, one person at a time seems like a really slow way to go, but interacting with other human beings is kind of a one person at a time thing when you get to that level. And that was a meaningful conversation to me too.
Yeah. Well, I think too that speaking with Bruce Gagnon, who started the campaign against nuclear weapons in space, who's been doing that for years.
Right.
He was a military brat, but he told me there's no such thing as fast organizing. There's only slow organizing, because so much of it is developing trust and developing relationships and reaching people at a heart level. And I think too that we are Eric Lawyer, who's going to be on the show in the second hour, just his story of his own transformational experience. It's not going to be instant for anybody. It's a challenging process. And we have to, it was funny when we were at the Power to the Peaceful Festival, they have this beautiful, beautiful music, and we try to be very respectful when we come in. We turn off our 9/11 truth impeachment songs, and we we're visually there, but we're not competing with the great music, which is why people go to the festival. And there was a guy with a blowhorn saying, 9/11 was an inside job. We're like, no, don't say that. We don't want to scare people. We want to win them over. We were passing out cookies and money and information. And just gently, you know, reach people where they were and not ruin their day. But, you know, people, we couldn't help but notice that some people's jaws dropped and just were totally stunned and got it for the first time. And we just try to be, you know, supportive and help them if they were, like, stunned by realizing that, oh, my God, I've been lied to.
Well, it is really stunning. You know, another thing for us to remember is that not only does everybody that we approach get it differently, but that activists are all different, too. And I'll just briefly, a lady called me a couple weeks ago during the RNC, DNC, and I have no idea who she was. She called and said, tell me that's new, not you on the television. I said, I don't have television. I'm in Kansas. What are you talking about? And she said, there are these people screaming, and I'm a Democrat, and I just want to be able to hear my candidates. This is my moment. I support you, but they're screaming. I thought about it, and I finally said to her, you know what? I remember being 20-something and being in the streets because Reagan was burning Central America and there was nothing left to do but go in the streets and scream. So I also understood that. And she got that, too. She said, oh, I remember. You're right. So yeah. Just different occasions call for different things.
Yes. We have a break.
Okay.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
War is over, if you want it. Peace.
Peace. P-E-A-C-E. P-E-A-C-E.
So this is springtime. The years have been dark. The sun is now shining. Love is the spark. So let's take this springtime and make a new day for all of the people, both here and far away.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm speaking with Janice Matthews, and Janice was also the organizer of a really great conference. It was called Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming the Future. It took place in Chicago back in June 2004, I remember. And I think that's really when the 9/11 Truth Movement sort of made that breakthrough through the mainstream press barrier. I mean, the acknowledgement that there really was a movement and bringing out some of the key points, and that was quite an accomplishment. It was a great, great event, and I think there's been a lot of conferences since then. Now, can you tell me because there's so many 9/11 truth groups right now, how is 9/11truth.org doing? Is it getting as much support as it needs, or does it need more help?
Let me say, you said 2004. I know you meant 2006, but if people are trying to look that up, and then also, you know, what made that really great was that there were a whole lot of people who came together and organized that. So Gabriel Day was also really, I mean, a key organizer of that. And then there was a committee of, gosh, I don't know what we had, probably 30 people at one point. And that's part of what made that. And they were from all over the nation. So we did most of the organizing, you know, well, all of the organizing on the telephone. And so many people came. I think the first night there were 750 people just for the first night event. And then I don't know how many over the course of the weekend. But people did network and meet each other and find out that they shared skills or passion. So some people said, wow, you're making movies? I'm going to work with you. Or you're doing public access TV? I really want to work with you. Or, you mean, you're researching this? And from across the nation, and some Canadians were there and the Italians were there that weekend. And it really blossomed after that. And so, 9/11truth.org does not have much financial support now. And in a way, that's really great, because our goal has always been to remain decentralized, because I personally believe that's the only thing that's ever succeeded and will as far as movement, and that when we have a decentralized organization, nobody can take down the organization by taking down a leader or you know, a board of directors or something. So we've tried to sort of offer services to everybody and encourage, I mean, from the very beginning, we brought in like 47 groups that had already started with the Visibility Project, and we won't say, here's what you have to do or here's what you can't do, which has caused a lot of consternation for people because we're used to being more organized in a different fashion. So I think, and the goal, of course, is that eventually there wouldn't be any need for a 9/11 truth movement organization. We've sort of put ourselves out of business, so to speak. So I think as more groups grow, it's a wonderful thing. And at the same time, it's harder. What I really want to do is make sure that everybody is able to find out what everybody's doing and support each other. And there are other groups that are also helping to do that. So, yeah, we don't have as much support as far as, like, trying to keep one full-time person. We can't do that anymore. And the website, we've cut back some because there's not as much time to do all the things we want to do at the website. And at the same time, on the other hand, it's a good thing. So that's the reality there. Yeah. We no longer have even one full-time person. So more people need to volunteer, I think, to do specific tasks as far as helping network our whole movement. So it's good and bad problem to have.
Yeah, I've noticed that there can be two groups in the same area without working synergistically with one another, and they don't know what one another is doing. But it's also a strength that there's so much happening that you can't keep up with everything. I remember a few years ago we had multiple 9/11 truth events happening in Marin, San Francisco, Oakland, you know, simultaneously, and it was great because people could choose which one they wanted to participate in. And then, but I think this is part of the nature of movements too, is they move from one stage to another, and they move into different different areas. So now, a lot of the energy that we used to put into our group, it's shifted. It's going into architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, and they have a fancy bells and whistles website, and we have like this nothing website. We've never done much with our website, and part of the reason is we have so many people who have their own websites, like Cosmos has Truth Action and Jim Hoffman has WTC7, and I have mine, and so we have our own, so we never collectively try to work on one. We're just doing too much. but it's good too.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It seems like it's a good problem to have, and it's also frustrating for people that we don't seem coordinated all the time. But for instance, you know, every year before the anniversary, we all discuss whether we should try to have a big march on Washington or New York City or what we should do. And, you know, this year is another example of people everywhere. And to me personally, first of all, I don't want to give Exxon a penny. And it's part of sort of walking our talk to not do that in a way. And also because participating in a republic, you have to do in your own backyard. And so there's something about being out locally instead of all gathered together in one place. It's really easy for people to ignore that if that's what they want to do. But when we're everywhere and we're walking, talking examples of being aware and paying attention and participating, I think that's really valuable. And that, when I look at this six-page list of events, I mean, one is just a beginning meeting if there's interest. Somebody wants to start a group. And, Students for Democratic Society.
There's another factor in here, too. And I remember in 2004, we did a lot to try to get people to New York for that anniversary, because the Republican National Convention was happening there, too. And
this year, that
makes a huge difference. I mean, I think our rally would have been much bigger, except all my friends were getting harassed by police in Denver and in Minneapolis. So it was hard to organize with most of the street activists out in Denver and in Minneapolis. And so the timing alone the fact mm-hmm. that all those events were happening just prior to 9/11 made it very difficult for people to do everything. Like, you had to choose, okay, am I going to do something local or am I going to go to Denver? You just can't do everything.
So, that's right. And most of us do have jobs and budgets, and, you know, it's tough. Somebody from Europe asked me why I wasn't going to be in New York, and I said, well, because it's going to be like $800 for me to get there and back, and just drive. We were talking about miles. And, no, I think it was $400 to drive there and back, and this person from this small country said, oh, I just didn't know that. So that's part of it. But I just think it's the reality, and I think it's a good thing.
Yes. Well, thank you, Janice, for all your hard work. I do appreciate everything that you've done.
Well, thanks, and thanks to you, too. I mean, we should one of these days go through your long history of giving and helping, too, you know. So everybody, Carol's done way more for way longer than I have. So thanks for having me on, Carol.
You're listening to We the People Radio Network.
Pure energy. We
the People Radio Network.
Well, hello, George. Yeah, the framers of our Constitution, fresh on the heels of a revolution. But it must have seen the writing on the wall. They secured for us an open door in Article 2 in Section 4 to commence a presidential overhaul. Now we've run this play a few times before with presidents and judges and governors, and now we see that our country is in distress. With thousands dying, Bush go lying, illegal torture, illegal spying, this is so much bigger than the stain on an intern's dress. I-M-P-E-A-C-H, seven little letters gonna set us straight. I-M-P-E-A-C-H, how much more are we gonna take? I-M-P-E-A-C-H, time to clean the White House out. Here we go.
That's Tom Chelton singing Impeach. And I must say, I still think that would be a great solution. I think if we had a media that was on the ball, that would have been done years and years ago. And joining with us is the media coordinator for 911truth.org, Mike Berger, and he is also the director of the film Improbable Collapse, The Demolition of Our Republic. And he's a filmmaker, a researcher, an activist, but more importantly, he's a media spokesperson, has been doing a lot to help try to get our message back through that almost insurmountable obstacle of the media. So welcome, Mike, to the show. And we have had some breakthroughs, but I think the timing is really interesting that the NIST report should come out just on the eve or the cusp of the Democratic conventions, where the story could just so quickly be forgotten and buried.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on, Carol. It's great speaking with you and your audience. It's been a while. You know, the timing of the NIST report is very interesting. Kevin Ryan actually was telling me that he expected them to release it actually the week before, so they released it just a little bit earlier than that. But of course, it gets buried right away. The interesting, I found the whole response to the NIST press conference to be really interesting. Janice and I were listening to the conference call that Richard Gage put on for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth right after the NIST press conference, and we both got slammed by calls from media outlets from all over the world. And it was interesting, not one of the alleged journalists who had called, when we referred them, gave them the phone number to listen into that conference call, not one of them took 5 minutes to listen to what structural engineers had to say in response to the report, or what any of the engineers or architects architects had to say. They basically continually hammered both of us to try to get comments, and I just found it fascinating that that none of these journalists wanted to get the opinion of an actual structural engineer, and I pointed this out to them. My opinion is irrelevant. I'm not an engineer. Why not get the views expressed by an actual structural engineer who's going through the report right now and giving their first take on the report? Not one of them did it. And
well, but the New York Times did mention Gage.
Yes. The New York Times did. However, I found the New York Times article even more fascinating in that the New York Times article reprinted the quote from the NIST press conference stating that their conclusion that explosives weren't used was based on the fact that there were no eyewitnesses, and it would have been very loud as if you were sitting in front of a rock concert, so there were no witnesses who described explosions. And the irony here is that it was the New York Times that sued the city of New York to release the oral histories gathered from the members of the New York Fire Department, in which over 100 witnesses described seeing and hearing explosions. So the paper of record forgot their own articles on the eyewitnesses, apparently.
Yeah.
So this is the paradox that we have when we deal with the media, is that the media focuses on whatever at the moment they choose to focus on in order to spin a story a certain way. And I think that our ability, I think we need to take a more sophisticated approach in dealing with the media and the public, and that we have to frame the issue very carefully and very selectively. I think that basically stating publicly to people who may not have had any contact with any of the information or haven't been exposed to any of the questions, didn't watch the 9/11 Commission report, or didn't watch any of the 9/11 Commission testimony, didn't read the report, when they see people saying that 9/11 was an inside job, they frankly probably have no clue what we're talking about. And they have a visceral reaction to it. As opposed to what I heard you speaking of earlier when you were on with Janice, about trying to reach people where they are. And we have to ask ourselves, what is our goal? Why are we doing this? If we're trying to get the truth out, we're trying to get the truth out to people who already disagree with our views or are maybe uninformed. It's not about convincing people who are already on our side and behind us. So we have to learn how to build a bridge to speak to people who basically have never been exposed to this information and to educate them in a way that is not confrontational. And I think that's the best thing that we can do to try to spread more of the truth of all the work that has now the incredible body of research that shows all the contradictions in the official story and that raises significant questions. And I had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago to go on a talk show, a radio talk show in the Midwest here in Kansas by a self-professed conservative. He calls himself a show's The Conscience of Kansas. And he's a former chief of police, and he wrote a book extolling the virtues of the Patriot Act and how wonderful it is and how it's kept us safe. And he invited me on the show and expected me, in his own words, to be a typical conspiracy theorist whack job. And in the opening dialogue that we had with each other, rather than being very confrontational like some conservatives can be, he actually allowed me, you know, he asked me intelligent questions, allowed me to respond without cutting me off. And in having that dialogue, basically we wound up having a one-hour dialogue about facts. And after the paradox of this whole thing was that at the end of the interview, after an hour, and the interview was only scheduled for 20 minutes because he thought he was going to be able to dismiss me as a lunatic. And in fact, he had a couple of good lines, like, you know, do you wake up in the morning and see Dick Cheney in your Cheerios? Which I thought was a really good line. But the interesting thing was after the hour, he said at the very end of the show, he goes, well, you know, I don't agree with anything you've said, but I'm glad that we had this hour to put out really good information.
Hmm.
So to me, that means there must have been some cracks that something had seeped through for him to say that. That was a really odd thing, I think, to say.
Yeah.
But what it demonstrates, I think, is that there is a way to take an approach with people where if you know, and you don't have to know everything there is to know about 9/11, but if you pick maybe 3 or 4 points and know them well, then you can communicate intelligently with people who are at least open to reasonable dialogue and discussing facts. And I think that's our greatest hope, is that what I'm seeing is that people who are at least willing to have this conversation, even if they don't agree with us, that there's the potential there to educate them and inform them and at least pique their curiosity so that maybe they'll look into it themselves. And I always frame it for these people, I always frame the issue as, well, if you believe everything the government has told you, then the issue is, really, it's about security. And that's usually how I frame this debate, especially with conservatives. If you believe that the whole objective here is to prevent another terrorist attack, so without going into it being an inside job, they have to at least acknowledge that if we don't know how the organizations and agencies that failed to protect us on 9/11 failed, then they have to acknowledge that we can't be any safer than we were before 9/11. And I think that creates an opening.
Yeah. Well, we have a break, and we'll be back with Mike in just a few minutes.
For crimes and lies, you'd like to see him kicked out on his push. Friend, you've got good reason. I support you absolutely. But this impeachment season, don't forget your civic duty. Impeach Cheney first. It can still get worse.
Hello. Welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm speaking with Mike Berger, and we're talking about the media, which has been, I would say, the biggest obstacle that the movement has faced. And the greatest resistance we found has been in the press and also with politicians. But I do think we have had successes. It's just taken a tremendous amount of time. I was telling Mike just before during the break that we had some success with a local journalist who interviewed me, and I mentioned that the approach that I took to 9/11 was the historical one and putting things in context, and he really loved Gray Brecken, who I mentioned, who was actually with us on our first march demanding a congressional investigation of 9/11. And Brecken wrote a book called Imperial San Francisco, Earthly Ruin. I can't remember the whole title of the book now. it slipped my mind. But it looks at the story of empire, and San Francisco has been the center of an empire, and how devastating it's been to the planet. But this reporter loved Gray Brecken's work and loved history, and he wrote a wonderful article in the North Bay Bohemian. It was their cover story, actually, and I haven't had a chance to post on the internet because I've been so busy. But I'll have to do that.
Well, and I was saying, and I was telling you during the break that that's a great example of being able to listen to where the other person is coming from and to make a personal connection. And if you can do that, then and the other person feels validated and that you're open to hearing their views, that it's not just a contest of convincing another person or persuading them of your view only, and it's a two-way street, something shifts when you make that connection. And some of the barriers come down and the resistance comes down to actually hearing what you have to say as well. And so creating that dialogue is really our greatest challenge, because it happens one-on-one. And that's really one of the things that I think we can emphasize and work on together as activists, is just learning how to approach people and kind of find out where they are. Because all the people, like after the NIST report came out, I got many phone calls and an awful lot of hate email. And I used to dismiss the hate email and not respond to it. And over the years now, in trying different responses to people when they write us hate mail, what I've discovered is most of the people who actually take the time to write you hate email, in many uh-huh. cases, really want to engage in a dialogue. And they just, they do it in a very, you know, odd way. But what I found is even if you can't persuade them, if you at least respond to them and let them know there's a human being on the other end, something shifts there. And actually, there are many times where many of these people who started out by writing incredibly hateful things have actually looked at some of the information or articles that I will send them after we go back and forth, and then actually start to ask questions themselves. So you never know. You never know what it takes. It's such an individual thing. But it is about making some type of a human connection.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems, too, that the more you push, the more resistance there is. And what you really want to do is allow people to question and be able to respond to that, but give them the space. So I think a gentle approach is probably the best. Although I must say it's a challenge. I remember being confronted by Marines who thought that Building 7 was something that left wing rag, the BBC, you know, came up with out of the blue. That you know that is the scary thing, I think, is the fact that sometimes we have these very disparate narratives. And I had a guy on my show who wrote a book called On the Causes of War, and he said, you know, wars start when you have events or a history and you have these completely different narratives over what happened. And so you have some people thinking the other people are complete liars or evil or whatever. And this is unfortunately what we do see happening in the United States. We have the dominant corporate myth, and then you have this other emerging story, and you have these giant competing stories. And I think, you know, that's where the battle is, and perhaps it's always been over the public mind on what's true and what's legitimate, what's not legitimate, and how we are these institutions oppressive, or are they serving us?
Well, you know, it has probably always been this way, but the thing that has changed about the times we live in now is that there's a continual assault on our senses of information from just the enormity now of the media, of 24-hour news, of thousands of talk radio shows, and they all have an inherent bias. I mean, look at what's going on in the media now, for example, with MSNBC's coverage of the conventions and the flack that's going on over Keith Olbermann's comments about, you know, the Republican convention showing and using images from 9/11. Basically, this polarization and this divisiveness that's been multiplied by the media, when you're constantly inundated with images and sound bites and emails, and from every direction, there's so much information hitting you at once. Part of the effectiveness of what the other side has that we don't is the ability to blast 24/7 on thousands of channels the same message or a similar message. And so I think one of our weaknesses has been the inability to commit to using talking points that we all agree to, so that we all come across on the same page and that we're unified. And the image of our movement is one, even from within, that's fractured and divided. And just that one small subtle change of maybe being able to agree to focus on a couple of specific talking points each month, whether it's in our, you know, local groups when we meet and speak, or when we show films, or when we have any kind of public event, if we were just to make that one simple change and just ask people if they would join us in committing to that and just setting two or three talking points, which we focus on each month and then change each month, overnight we could create a more unified message, which would begin to challenge some of what the corporate media does. I don't think that in and of itself is enough, but it would certainly go a long way to at least giving the image that we're all unified and that we have the same message, and we have a simple message, which is, you know, look at all the contradictions on the public record. Look at all the people who've stood up. For me, one of the most fascinating things after the NIST report release was to turn on CNN and see Wolf Blitzer standing in front of a video clip of Seven over and over again. And this was the same network, CNN, that when I was asked to be a guest on the Glenn Beck Show, told me that they had a policy at CNN of not showing collapsing buildings.
Well, isn't it an accomplishment that we forced this report out? I mean, and that now probably more people know that Building 7 existed and collapsed. I mean, before
accomplishment. Absolutely, and one of my first responses when we started getting hate mail was the first thing I would ask them is, now you're an expert? You didn't even know Building 7 existed 24 hours ago. But now you know everything about it, because you saw Wolf Blitzer say it was a fire, not even a diesel fire. So, yeah, it's interesting, but what it seemed to have done is given a good shakeup to people who have not followed this or have not come across any of this information. And frankly, I think it was, from what I was seeing from the response, it had to have been jarring to all of a sudden learn that this, you know, enormous building disappeared that day, and they didn't even know.
Well, I heard from an activist that they showed a great 9/11 truth documentary in Europe, and then the next day they showed another documentary just completely obliterating it, and I think maybe that's it. They just wait until they have the club to bash whatever, you know, we say, and until they're really comfortable with it, so that they know their talking points, and then they think, okay, we'll put this out, and then we'll just bash them. It's like with the Kennedy assassination. Every time somebody brought forward some new evidence indicating that there was a conspiracy, then the corporate media or the press would come out with some outlandish new computerized magic bullet.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Ah, my God, we're out. There goes the whole.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.